On October 10th, check at Shania Twink, followed by the Arrogant Worms on October 11th at Broom Factory. Sloan hits the Ale House on October 18th, and folks can catch the Grapes of Wrath on October 22nd, Crywank on November 1st, and Georgia Harmer on November 8th at the Broom. Billy Faffel, Guy Davis, and Rhea May are also playing at the Broom on November 12th, 15th, and 16th, respectively. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com. Visit the Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information.
Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way for you to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Mateos Kervet, who is finishing up his master's in computing under the supervision of Dr. Sidney Gavigi. Welcome to GradChat.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I know you're finishing up your master's, which is quite exciting. Or your thesis is titled Collaborative Perception Under Adverse Weather Conditions. Can you tell us a little bit what that means?
Sure. So collaborative perception is a subfield of perception for autonomous vehicles.
Okay.
So making a vehicle drive by themselves is a very challenging thing. There's a lot of parts to it. And the usual description is that you have to first get sensing information from the sensors, cameras, radar, GPS, LiDAR, and then making sense of what's around the vehicle. Then you use that information to make decisions.
Okay.
With those decisions, then you have to specifically determine what are the actions to be done. Mm. So accelerate, brake, turn left, right, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of steps to it.
Mm-hmm.
My research focused on the very beginning, which is the perception part, is making sense of the data that comes from the sensors, you know? And within perception, there is this kind of new subfield, which is collaborative perception, which has the idea that, well, in maybe a few years' time, we'll have lots of autonomous vehicles around. Mm-hmm. So what if they could tell each other what they're perceiving, you know?
Mm.
So if there is challenging scenarios like occlusion, for instance, or situations like adverse weather where the performance of the sensors is degraded, if they can tell each other what they're perceiving, it makes everything safer, you know? So my master's focus specifically on collaborative perception under adverse weather conditions, because collaborative perception is a field that I would say it's roughly 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, wow. So you're right on the cutting edge. You're on the cusp of very new things. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And even though the field has 4 or 5 years old, there's been very, very little research done on how that can be done in the context of adverse weather conditions like rain, fog, you know.
So you mentioned there's a lot of different information and data coming in from all these different sensors and I guess things that are giving the autonomous vehicle input, and then you're trying to make all of these different systems within each vehicle speak to one another. So how does that all work? How do you parse through all of that information, and how do you assist the autonomous vehicle in making decisions based on its perception and the perception of other vehicles around it?
Yeah, it is pretty challenging.
Yeah, so it sounds very complicated.
It is. But it's fun. I really enjoy it. So there's different approaches to it. And the approach that has been most used in the literature is that if you just take raw sensor information, that's too much data. You know, so you have to communicate that data, and ideally you would do that in almost real time, right? So raw data is too much. But every autonomous vehicle, even the ones that are working by themselves, the way we make sense of all that data is with AI. It's with deep learning models. So if we use the result of my AI model, so the what was what it perceived around it, if we just use that result, then it's too little information, you know, because what if the model doesn't get things perfectly, you know, and then the errors compound, you know, so, and you end up losing information about the surroundings, you know, so what people usually do is within the deep learned model, they get the intermediate features, you know, and then that those features are communicated. And then for collaborative perception, we need models that will take as input data from different vehicles, you know, and you can even make other agents collaborate as well. There is research being done for having drones collaborating with the vehicles. There's some people, I don't think that is a very promising step, but there is some people also considering, I don't know, having data from smartphones. You know, so pedestrians could be joining the collaboration scheme. But the main thing is having either just cars or cars and roadside units. So you have, I don't know, cameras at an intersection. You know, those cameras could be like joining the collaboration and telling everyone, hey, there's this happening there.
There was a fender bender at this intersection and be aware. Well, it sounds like, because I can only imagine how hard it would be to compare different information from one type of vehicle to another, because I'm it sounds a little bit like comparing apples to oranges at times, right? If, you know, the weather conditions affecting a drone might be very different than those affecting a vehicle and what they have to be concerned about. So as from a very public armchair perspective, I can understand how like making those kind of connections could be difficult. So trying to find data that is valuable across vehicles and across other agents, like you said, that can all better inform driving. And I can only imagine, but I guess you can tell me more, what makes adverse weather conditions so challenging for autonomous vehicles? Because I'm thinking even, you know, driving in Kingston winters, you know, one street to the next, the road conditions can really vary. So could you tell us a little bit about what makes these conditions challenging for autonomous vehicles, and how can collaborative perception help with some of those challenges?
So just making a car drive by themselves is a very challenging thing, but it has been done, you know. And we have everyone that drives knows this, we have a lot of boring scenarios in driving. Most of driving is very boring, you know. It's just, oh, I have to keep on my lane, you know, like make sure no one like just jump ahead of me, you know.
And many times, right, if you drive the same route all the time, sometimes your mind wanders and all of a sudden you're like, I'm at work again. How did I get here safely? But you just do those automatic boring things.
Most of it, and the research shows that it's something like 98% of driving, it's so boring. It's so predictable, you know, but you have those edge cases, you know, you have those crazy situations that you have to react in a split second, right? So adverse weather goes more towards that edge case scenario thing, because it doesn't rain all the time. It doesn't snow all the time. It's not completely foggy that you can't even see in front of you properly. You know, that happens, I don't know, a couple of days a year, you know?
And not even consistently across an area, right? You drive through one patch of fog and then cross the street and then the fog's lifted a little bit. So it's constantly evolving.
Exactly, exactly. And even an adverse weather condition that I tried to explore in my master's was glare. So it's the sun is setting or the sun is rising, and then you have that super blinding light like right in front of you, you know? So if you just turn right, there's no more light bothering you, you know? So it changes a lot. So those kinds of situations, they don't happen all the time, and they make the sensor performance like really, really degrade, you know? So the same way it's challenging for us to make sense of things when it's too dark, when it's too foggy, when there's so much rain or snow that you can barely see, I don't know, like 20 meters in front of you. The same thing is true for sensors like cameras and even LiDARs, you know. So by having vehicles collaborating, we can hope that, well, I can only see 20 meters in front of me, but 20 meters in front of me, there might be a vehicle that can tell me what he's seeing, you know? Mm-hmm, so we can all share our perceptions, and then we can have a much broader field of view, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's something that really helps to increase the perception when those challenging situations happen.
Oh, no, that sounds helpful for those who are looking to kind of crowdsource safety on the road. Yeah. So this, it makes a lot of sense. This work seems very applied. But how have you tested all of this? So what have you been doing during your master's to try all of this? Because I imagine you can't exactly take AVs out on the road around Kingston at this point to do this type of testing. So how have you been approaching this in your master's?
Yeah, you mentioned something that is a very big challenge and within this specific subfield that I entered, which is getting real data. This is so tricky. Queens has, I think, more than one autonomous vehicle. Oh. Mm-hmm. And there's the auto drive team, the undergrad team, they have a car. My supervisor with another professor, Professor Nuruddin, they also have a car, which recently they even published a huge data set with the car getting data around Kingston.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for collaborative perception, you need more than one.
Yes.
One is not enough anymore. And for collaborative perception under adverse weather conditions, you can't collect data anytime. Mm-hmm. You need those adverse weather situations to happen. Mm-hmm. So it makes it super impractical to get real data. So the answer was, okay, let's go to simulation.
Oh, you good. Yes, you can't wait for a winter storm and then hope that you can get data that day, right?
So, yeah.
So what type
of simulations?
Foggy.
Let's get the car.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I'm sure the car is a heavily scheduled hot commodity as well if everyone is wanting to use the AV. So you develop simulations or you work with those. How does that play out?
Yeah, so there is a very popular open source simulator used by people in self-driving research called Carla.
Okay.
And Carla, think of it as a kind of a sandbox thing, a sandbox world where it can decide where you are going to put a car. It has some maps with cities and intersections and things like that. But you have a lot of freedom to do so many different things within Carla. It's for people that have worked with game design, it's pretty much like having a game engine with some pre-made assets there.
Okay.
So within Carla, we set up everything, set up scenarios, and we set up scenarios that felt meaningful from a practical point of view. We wanted scenarios that were challenging, scenarios that really made the perception algorithms to struggle and to see if collaborative perception would make those situations better. So we looked at real data from lots of reports from the United States National Health Traffic Administration, and we found some interesting situations. Because in the field, sometimes people will just randomly decide, well, highways are an interesting situation. Off ramps from highways, they're an interesting scenario. And then you see the real data, and in fact those are not the most interesting scenarios, you know, for perception.
So no problem getting merging or getting off of the highway, but
not from a perception point of view, because those situations you can perceive your environment very well. Those might be more challenging from a perspective of control of how you control the car when it's going faster, right? But then that's later in the, in the pipeline.
You're still at the beginning, of the process.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we got data from what would be interesting scenarios for perception algorithms.
So and what are some of those interesting scenarios? What are some examples of what is hard to perceive?
So lots and lots and lots of crashes happen in intersections.
Okay.
Intersections are challenging because there's a lot of variables, right? A lot of erratic behavior, right? So We consider both urban scenarios and rural scenarios. And in rural scenarios, there's a lot of things involved. Curved roads, you know, when you get a known junction, you have accidents happening and troubles with perceiving objects around you. In level roads, non-level roads, you know, straight roads, there's a whole variety to it, you know. So we basically picked up five scenarios, we tried to make them a little bit general, not extremely specific. And then by using those five road configurations, then we simulated lots of different adverse weather combinations there. So clear weather, of course, we need to have a baseline, but also light rain, heavy rain, fog, foggy heavy rain. have you ever seen that?
It is not pleasant to drive in.
Not at all. and even glare, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Glare, from all that we looked in the literature, it was not something that was explored in collaborative perception. So, well, let's do it, right? And the results for glare were pretty interesting because when we are thinking about collaborative perception, there's always a main vehicle, right? The main vehicle we call the ego, meaning like the self, right? So the ego, its perception in glare, it's terrible because there's a lot of light, very strong light coming its way. But by collaborating with the other agents, it's so much better, you know? It's improved so much, you know? Yeah.
Oh, so that's well, it makes sense though, right? As soon as you can get away from that one bit of sunlight, you're able to see again as a human driver. So it makes a lot of sense with collaborative perception as well, that as long as you can pull data from other places that aren't, you know, driving straight into the sunset, you're able to make better sense of the road areas around and go from there. So you did a lot of testing. What is something from your research that you would like to pursue further? Like what's something you want to know more of now that you've done all of this work for your master's?
Yeah. So the main thing of the master's was creating the simulated data set and simulating all those scenarios and making sure everything was running smoothly, that everything made sense. We looked at real data to account for which scenarios to pick, what kind of sensor configurations to use and everything. But then once the data set was done, we had this idea to, well, now that we have those adverse weather scenarios that are challenging for collaborative perception AI models, let's make a model then. And that was so challenging. That was so difficult. And it's something we tried to do, but then because of the timing of the masters, that's something we put aside.
Okay.
And instead, our idea was, okay, let's look at the existing models and improve their robustness to adverse weather. And that's what I did at the last few months of my master's. But definitely then that would be an avenue for future research, right? To create a model that an AI model that is a lot more robust to all those adverse weather conditions that we have created in the simulation.
Is that something that you would like to pursue in the future? Or, because I know you mentioned you wanted to be a researcher, is that a next step for your research? Or what is your next step for your research?
To be completely honest, I don't know.
That's totally fair, yeah.
It is a very interesting field, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I already got a lot of familiarity with it. I will be doing my PhD here at Queen's.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Starting in September. So people listening to this, I will not be a master's student anymore. I'll be a PhD already.
Yes, you will. That'll be exciting.
Yeah. So in my PhD, the idea is to keep working with autonomous vehicles and perception for them. But what specifically are we going to target? Mm-hmm. That is still not defined, especially because in the PhD, you have a lot more time.
Yes, you'll have. Yes. Hopefully double the time, right? And ideally to deep dive into something. And now that you've already done all of this work, if you continue pursuing this, you have already a wealth of knowledge to work from instead of having to start from scratch, so to say, right?
Yeah.
So.
No, but at the same time, as I was doing all this work and reading about the field, there are a lot of open questions that we found, a lot of different things that could be worked on. And even in the context of adverse weather conditions, there's a question of how to do that. So thinking of an AI model, there's lots of different kinds of AI models being used nowadays. So one thing that has been used a lot for single vehicle perception that I don't think I have seen for collaborative perception is something called the diffusion model.
Okay.
So that's something that could be used. LLMs like ChatGPT, which are the large language models, there's people doing visual large language models and vision large language models, sorry. And how to integrate those large models to the self-driving pipeline, you know? So there's a lot of things that are very, very important right now for self-driving and collaborative perception. So Let's see.
Yes. It sounds like you're going to have the challenge of trying to pare down all of your interests and ideas, not having, you're going to have to be selective, I guess. And so you've almost got too many options, I think is a good place to be, right? Yeah. You get to explore a little bit and then find what feels best.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. Well, as this airs, we'll be excited to see how you're doing in your PhD, and hopefully we can have you back on Grad Chat in the future once you've kind of chosen the direction and you've got some more work done. But I hear that you're also, outside of your research on vehicles, this is a bit of a stretch, but I know you're also a big Formula One fan.
I am.
So who are your favorite drivers right now, and what is exciting to you about Formula One?
Lewis Hamilton.
Very nice.
When I started watching Formula One, I felt a little off about him. Mm-hmm. He seemed like that kind of celebrity that this is very fake, mm-hmm. you know? And then I realized, I saw some interviews, you know, and I realized that he's actually very real, you know, and he's a very big activist for a lot of causes. The main one being having black kids in STEM, you know, in motorsport, but also just in engineering as a whole. So he has a lot of initiatives. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of things that he doesn't even advertise about, you know.
Okay.
The Met Gala, he once got a full table with black designers.
Very nice.
And it's not something that he advertised much, you know. It just, the Met Gala happened and there he was in a table with lots of designers that he sponsored, you know. So he's the kind of people that puts his money where his mouth is. Mm-hmm. So
he just acts quietly on his values and then people report on it after, but he's just doing that because that's who he is. That's what it sounds like.
So I got to really admire Lewis Hamilton as I got to watch more and more Formula One, but unfortunately right now he's not doing the best. So he will not be a champion this year, probably not. So a champion contender right now is to be possibly his first champion will be Oscar Piastri, and he's the guy I'm hoping. Let's go Piastri.
And what do you like about Formula One? What excites you about it?
It's the racing itself is so much fun. There's a lot of unpredictability. There are races that are honestly very boring, that the way it begins, it's the way it ends. But when you least expect, you will see insanely good drives from the drivers. You see, I don't know, it starts to rain and then everyone has to stop and puts the wet tires, and then things become chaotic. And then it's when you see the drivers and their skill really making a difference. But it's also a team sport. Every driver is part of a team and they have a teammate, and sometimes you see the team making a lot of the difference with crazy strategies. Something like, oh, this is not going to work, but then it does,
and then
they win the race, and you're on the edge of your seat. How did that work, you know?
It sounds like, what I'm hearing, it sounds like there's a lot of similarity between kind of what you described in your research, right? It's sometimes, a lot of the time, driving can be pretty boring, maybe not Formula One boring, but it can be pretty regular, and then when there's these kind of challenges or adverse conditions, everyone adjusts, and that's the excitement piece. And that sounds kind of, I mean, I could be stretching here, but that sounds like what you're doing as well, as you're stretching and finding those challenges and then coming up with a solution within your team, within your lab, really quickly, and trying to figure out how to come around those.
Yeah.
And I know from the beginning you mentioned that you have really enjoyed your time in Kingston, and I know you've been quite active, and I see that you were an events ambassador for Queens. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Sure. Yeah. So there's this group in Queens called Queens Events. So anyone can go to their Instagram, Queens Events. And it's basically, this idea started by an alumni, Sarah Witiuk, I think that's how you pronounce her name. And it was this whole idea of giving people the information of what's happening in Kingston. Because she felt that a lot of the times she would hear about the cool things happening after they happened. So there's that whole FOMO kind of feeling, you know. And so let's give that information to students, and let's try to put all that information together. So I started following the page before moving to Canada. I got my acceptance, I think it was something like March.
Okay.
And then I just came in end of August to Kingston. So I wanted to know everything about Queens, about Kingston, and even CFRC. I was listening to CFRC before coming here, and it was a lot of fun. And by following the Queen's Events Instagram page, I saw that they had a position open for an ambassador. Mm. And the idea is simple. You just go to events and you post about it so people can see what's mm-hmm. how the event is, right? And then I did that for my first year here in Kingston. I did that and it was so much fun. It was a great excuse to just mm-hmm. leave home and go explore the city and find cool things to do.
Yeah, because there's so many things happening
yeah.
in Kingston and at Queens that you almost don't know what to choose. So yeah. what were some of your favorite events from that year while you were an ambassador? What are some things you tried?
Oh, wow. I went to so many concerts, more indie rock concerts, classical music mm-hmm. at the Isabel. I would say that my number one favorite was the Intercultural Arts Fest. Mm-hmm. It happens every year, mm-hmm. so I think it's in August. So
that sounds right to me. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So people hearing, go next year.
Yes.
But coming from Brazil, in Brazil, you don't have as much multiculturalism mm-hmm. as you have in Canada. Brazil is a melting pot of cultures. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of people coming from all over the world, you know, to Brazil. But then you don't see those cultures as they were originally. Mm-hmm. It all gets blended together, mm-hmm. you know. So, I don't know, we have sushi pizza, like we have had them for years, you know. Mm-hmm. There's the Russian dish stroganoff, mm-hmm. and there's the Arab dish sfiha. Mm-hmm. We have stroganoff, sfiha, you know, like Brazil does this crazy combinations of things. So you have a very varied mm-hmm. and diverse culture, but you don't really have the traditions. Mm-hmm. You don't have the originals.
More of the nuance to yeah. some of the traditions. And,
yeah.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. coming to Canada and going to the Intercultural Arts Fest, mm-hmm. I saw traditional dance, mm-hmm. traditional mm-hmm. music, you know, from all over the world. Traditional dishes, those were so good, mm-hmm. you know. So it felt really special and it reminded me why, when deciding where to do my master's, mm-hmm. the country I picked was Canada. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was not only because of research excellence mm-hmm. and because it's a great place to live, but because of the multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. I felt mm-hmm. like Canada would be a country where I would be welcomed and that I would get to meet people from all over the world and their cultures would be appreciated here. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely the case. And it's awesome.
Well, I'm glad that you had great experiences with Queen's Events, and hopefully, like you said, everyone listening can attend next summer's Intercultural Fair Arts Fest
yeah.
And check out some amazing events throughout the whole year in the community and on campus, because there's so much going on.
Yeah,
right?
I sometimes talk to people and they say, there's nothing happening in Kingston. And then I look at them baffled. What do you mean? There's so much going on, you know? I think it's just a matter of what you look for and mm-hmm. where to look for, you know? So the city of Kingston itself organizes so many things. Mm-hmm. At Queens, you have so many student groups and even the groups from the university, like the School of Graduate mm-hmm. Studies. There's so many things happening all the time.
There are. And if I can pitch the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, we have an excellent weekly newsletter that tries to compile events mostly on campus, but we do include off-campus events as well, and things, scholarships, events, opportunities. So that's one way to stay in touch and get a heads up about some of the stuff that's happening around.
Yeah, for sure. For anyone thinking Kingston doesn't have much to do, I would say just think about what interests you and look out. I would say that there is, mm-hmm. you know, there's things happening for every type of interest. Mm-hmm. For people more interested in sports, there's so many games happening all year
and
long.
So many teams yeah. that you can join. And
yeah, mm-hmm. music, mm-hmm. arts, you know, crafts, mm-hmm. more nerdy things, you know, like board games. Mm-hmm. There's things for everyone.
Yes, we're very, very lucky to have
yeah.
strong communities. Well, thank you so much, Mateos. It's been great chatting with you. Thanks for doing Grad Chat, and good luck with the PhD. And as I said, hopefully we'll get a chance to speak with you as your doctoral research gets underway in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun to talk to you.
Well, so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Today on Wings.
If we imagine zero-sum power as this upright triangle, what might the alternative look like? I want us to ovalize the hierarchy.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. At U.S. National Women's Studies Association 2000, the keynote speaker was Lani Guinier. In 1993, President Clinton withdrew Guinier's name from nomination as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights because she was attacked for writings on political affirmative action. Now Guinier is the first black woman tenured law professor at Harvard University. Lani Guinier.
Many of us who are committed to ideals of feminism, of social justice, of racial justice, have found ourselves, as one of my colleagues likes to say, climbing backwards up the cheese grater. Climbing backwards up the cheese grater is the path that many of us take as we try one by one to make it to the top of the hierarchy of zero-sum power. Right, and you imagine your cheese grater, and as you grate that cheese, important pieces of it fall off. And the sense of who are we, even if we succeed in repopulating zero-sum hierarchies of power, is the question I want to put forward tonight. And I want to start by telling a story about a going away party that some friends of my then 11-year-old son had for him when we were leaving Philadelphia to come to Boston. The children at this party were organized to play a relay race in which the competition was structured as the boys versus the girls. The goal of the race was to carry a golf ball on a spoon without dropping the ball or letting your hands touch the ball. Okay, so it's a relay race carrying a golf ball on a spoon. They ran the race 2 times, both times the girls won. The girls won, it seemed, at least on first observation, because they kept their eyes on the ball. The boys focused on the outcome and assumed that raw speed would get them first to the finish line, which after all was the object of the game in their mind. The boys quickly became aware of the fact that they were losing because speed alone does not keep a golf ball on a spoon, and they therefore began to experiment with different and devious strategies to advance swiftly to the finish line. They threw the golf ball forward toward the finish line, which technically did not violate the no-touch rule because they did not actually touch the ball with their hand. They palmed the cup of the spoon in their hand rather than holding the stem of the spoon, but none of their efforts to bend the rules enabled their team to finish first. The girls' team still won. Now, as this game is going on, a group of us, many of us academics, are sitting and observing the game. And of course, the first thing we do is to deconstruct the game. So the initial spin among my adult friends is that the game symbolized contemporary gender dynamics, the differences attributed either to the cultural or natural tendencies of boys and girls at play. Right? Girls are better at fine motor skills, boys have gross motor skills. Girls are more people-oriented, they're more oriented to preserving their relationships. Girls don't cheat. but follow the rules, cooperate with authority, rather than challenge or resist it. Indeed, because girls are traditionally considered powerless, in a culture in which power is zero sum and controlling, the girls substitute a network of relationships for their individual weaknesses. Thus, girls care more about making friends, not winning games or dominating opponents. My mom was there. She was 80 years old. And she interrupted this conversation to ask a simple question. Who designed the game? The girls. They were the official hosts of the party, and the girls apparently designed the game to play to their strengths. And then they did something very clever. They called it a game, which made the boys assume that it played to their strengths, since it was a game and it involved physical activity. Before returning to gender stereotypes, let me just add one further detail. When the girls were asked to pose for a picture of the winners, the girls assumed the following stance. I am so tough, just see my muscles. Right? The girls, in other words, became boys. As the winners, the girls then went on to play other games that they also designed, which did not include the boys. Now, at this point, my son, right, thought he was the guest of honor. He's now quite upset. And I asked him, why doesn't he just go off and play with the other boys? And he said, because the girls are excluding him and the girls are the majority. And in fact, there were more girls than boys at this party. Now, I want to talk about the three faces of zero-sum power, the traditional or conventional view of power using this golf ball game, because the argument that I want to put forward tonight is that many of us have become preoccupied only with the first face, who wins the game. And we forget the second face, which is who designs the rules of the game, or the third face, which is what do we call that competition that is taking place before us. So the first face is the visible conflict, that's the relay race as it is observed by the adults. The second face, or the second dimension, is the agenda, the rules that are set to, in many ways, predict the outcome of the conflict. And then the third face, which is what those of us in the academy call the meta-narrative, the story we tell. It is the story usually constructed by the winners, and it is the story that convinces both the winners and the losers that they each deserve their lot in life. Very important role of the meta-narrative, to convince both the winners and the losers that they each deserve their lot in life. Now, I want to return to this idea, is the ultimate vision simply to become winners who are in a position to exercise zero-sum power, meaning power over others. In our society, we are thinking of an upright triangle, and as you get closer to the top, you presumably become more powerful, but there are also presumably fewer of you. So part of the goal in getting to the top is to join an exclusive club. Now, Peggy McIntosh talks about curricular reform development, and she talks about five phases. I just want to talk about two of them. The first phase is what she calls womanless history. Like most history, it is written by the winners. So what made many of the women in this room angry is the fact that history was written by the winners, and it just so happened that all of the winners were men, and they wrote about other men. But then she says the corrective to this first phase may be as damaging as the first phase. that many of her colleagues and she have come to see it as worse than the traditional curriculum in that it pretends to show us women, but really shows us only a famous few or makes a place for the newly declared or a newly resurrected famous few. McIntosh compares phase two with an affirmative action program which implies that institutions are model places which need only to help a few of the inferior others to have the opportunity to climb onto these pinnacles with their superiors. Phase two curricular policies assume that our disciplines are basically functioning well and that all women or blacks or Chicanos would need or want is to be put into higher slots on the reading list. If in phase two the historian spotlight is simply trained a little lower than usual on the pinnacles, we now see people like Susan B. Anthony trying to scramble up the rocks, but all the other women on behalf of whom she was speaking remain invisible. And that is the claim I want to talk about. How can we claim to be successful simply by virtue of the fact that there are so many more of us who are in positions of power when so many who look just like us still remain invisible? I want us to ovalize the hierarchy, where instead of thinking of power as something one holds over others, as something one hoards in order to exclude others, we think of power as something that is shared, that is generative, that is creative, that becomes bigger than the sum of its parts. I see that as only new because we haven't been talking about it. It's not new because many women, many people of color have been thinking about this. They simply haven't yet articulated it. And I think it's really important to put this view of power on the table so that as we are climbing up this cheese grater backwards, we can begin to question what is the vision that we are seeking in the long term. Short term, yes, we may need to repopulate the hierarchy. But long term, what is our vision of social change? And I want to propose a few examples of what might it look like to ovalize power. New York City used to have a height requirement. You had to be 5'10" in order to be a police officer. And obviously, this height requirement made it difficult for many women to be police officers. They challenged this under traditional anti-discrimination law, saying this did not treat women equally to men. New York City was forced to eliminate the height requirement and hire more women, but also more Latino men, more Asian men, more short white men. To me, that was just the beginning of the story, not the end of the story, although that tends to be the only story that we tell. How women now have opportunity to become police officers just like men. As if the position that men assumed is the default position, it is normal, it is ideal, and it is what we should all aspire to. A group of black and Puerto Rican women who became police officers under this new consent decree and who were not 5'10" tall took a different approach to their job. 5'10" was not just a description of a tall man. It was also the description of a good cop. It normalized the idea that in order to be a good cop, you had to be big because you had to be able to intimidate. Your goal in maintaining the peace was to control, to establish your superior strength, to assume power over, so that in any visible conflict, you would win. These women came in And they were assigned to patrol a housing project, and their strategy was a little different. They attempted to identify adolescents who had a criminal record and who had a reputation of getting into trouble. And then they reached out and mentored them. They reached out and showed these young adolescents respect. And many of these young boys, most of them were boys, restrained their own behavior, grateful for the caring attention of an adult. And the incidence of violent crime in these housing projects went down. This is not just an aberration that took place in New York City in a couple of housing projects. When the Christopher Commission was convened to investigate police misconduct in Los Angeles as a result of the Rodney King beating that was televised, the conclusion was simple: hire more women. If you want to do something about police brutality, hire more women. It was not that women are unwilling to draw their weapons when necessary. It was that the women were more inclined to seek to dissipate conflict first. And through the effort of communicating, they made it unnecessary to draw their weapons. Now, the point here is, yes, we want to include more women, we want to include more people of color, we want to make this a fairer society. But in the process, we also have to rethink the job that all of us are doing. This is not about charismatic leadership, this is about building something Marshall Gans calls charismatic communities. Communities in which we come together because we are committed to a vision of justice, because we feel the energy of our collective engagement, because we experience joy, and because we realize that if we work together creatively, we will be able to solve problems innovatively to transform the society on behalf of everyone. I use the metaphor of the miner's canary to describe this phenomenon. The miners used to take a canary into the mines to alert them when the atmosphere in the mines was too toxic for the miners. And the canary's more fragile respiratory system would give way, signaling that there was a problem with the atmosphere in the mines. And the argument that I'm making is that the experience of women, the experience of gays and lesbians, the experience of people of color, the experience of the disabled, the experience of all of those who've been left out is the experience of the canary. We have been convinced that the problem is located in the canary, and the solution is to outfit the canary with a little pint-sized gas mask so that it can withstand the toxic atmosphere in the mines. I would like to see us fix the mines. So when somebody says the goal of this group is to feminize higher education, that is not about putting women in charge of men so that women can do to men what men have done to women. The goal is to ovalize higher education so that everyone can learn better. So I want to tell you another story. This is involving some African-American math students in California. Uri Treisman is a calculus professor. He noticed his African-American students were not doing as well as many of his Chinese-American students, and he asked his colleagues what was their speculation. And they came up with the traditional stereotypes, right? The problem is in the canary. All of these African-American calculus students come from single-parent families. They didn't have a very good high school math program at their school. They're not studying very hard. Uri Treisman decided to test his colleagues' assumptions, and he hired researchers to follow the African-American and the Chinese-American students around, and he found that, in fact, his colleagues were wrong. The African-American students were studying harder than the Chinese-American students. If you count studying, sitting in your dorm room with a calculus book open, studying alone. The Chinese American students were studying calculus with each other as they went to lunch, as they ate lunch in their dormitory room, in the study hall. It was intellectual engagement with peers that enabled the Chinese American students to develop intellectual self-confidence. They could ask questions when they didn't understand the answer. They could seek help when they needed it. It was that process that gave them the ability to master the conceptually difficult challenge of calculus. So Uri Treisman designed a peer workshop, modeled it on what he had seen the Chinese American students doing, served food, right? They had been studying over lunch. He figured this created an informal atmosphere. Brought in recent past learners to help answer questions, gave all the students problems, encouraged them to work on the problems jointly. Within the first semester, the African American students in the peer workshop started to do much better in calculus, and by the end of the second semester, they were among the highest scoring calculus students in the class. Now, Uri Treisman realized that the problem was inside of him. He was the sage on the stage. He was talking at all of his calculus students while they passively sat there individually taking notes. He then introduced the concept of group learning into his classroom to benefit all of his students. Rather than simply trying to fix the canary, he changed the atmosphere in the minds. This is a model in which leadership is not just about individual advancement. When so many more people who look like them remain invisible. So I did a study of women law students. I was motivated by one of my students who had observed certain things in the classroom. This is at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. One of the things she had observed was a game called Asshole Bingo. This is an anti-intellectual game played by predicting on a little bingo board who is going to raise their hand to speak in class that day. The men on the bingo board were assholes. The women on the bingo board were man-hating femi-Nazi dykes, sexualized in the spirit of anti-intellectual good fun. So Anne wants to do a little movie about this, and so I convinced her to do a survey, and the results of the survey were very dramatic. It was as if the men and women were attending different law schools. The men said they felt perfectly comfortable speaking in class, perfectly comfortable asking questions. First-year women, two-thirds said they never spoke in class. That bothered them. Third-year women, two-thirds never spoke in class. It no longer bothered them. So we got grades, all of the academic performance records for all 3 years, because men and women came into the University of Pennsylvania with virtually the same credentials, slightly higher LSAT scores for the men, but statistically insignificant difference, slightly higher undergraduate GPA for the women, but statistically insignificant difference. The men had three times as great a chance of being in the top 10% of their class, 1.5 times as great a chance of being in the top 50% as the women, and that difference was sustained over the 3 years. Now, this bothered me. To my colleagues, I said, what do you think is going on here? Varsity sports, this is the theory. My colleague was trying to explain this difference. He said, well, during college, the men participate in sports and therefore don't pay enough attention to their academic studies. But then they get to law school and there are no varsity sports, and so their true academic potential emerges. He had a kernel of an idea there. Going back to that relay race, right? If you want to get the boys involved, what do? You call it a game. And basically what he was saying is that the way you get the boys involved in law school is to see winning at the game of the Socratic method as the goal. And how do you win? You raise your hand. How do you win? You raise your hand to be first. Now here's the problem. You haven't yet thought of what it is you want to say, right? You therefore speak at some length because you are thinking aloud and you are treating everyone to your thinking processes. You are developing important leadership skills, learning how to hold an audience. What are the girls doing? Or at this point, the women? They're sitting back editing their comments. They want to make what they say relevant. They don't see this as a game, they see it as a conversation. They see it as building an educational community. They revise their comments. By the time they raise their hand, what they say is so brief, so pithy, that only they and the professor know what it is that they have just referred to. People say, oh, we've got to fix these women because lawyers are aggressive, lawyers are competitive, lawyers need to be able to speak out. I have been a lawyer. I have never been to court in which the model of lawyering that is portrayed in the Socratic classroom fit the model of that courtroom, right? I had prepared my case. I had talked to other people about my case. I'd even talked to the witnesses. But we don't necessarily encourage research. It's the same thing on the math portion of the SAT. Girls score 40 points lower than boys, and yet in college math classes, they do just as well. But on the math portion of the SAT, when you ask the girls what was happening during the course of that exam, they tell you, I was trying to work through the problem before putting down the answer. Very bad strategy. The boys treat it as a pinball machine. Quick strategic guessing with less than perfect information. So again, look at the problems that converge around the canary. This is about fixing not the girls so that they can play pinball on the math portion of the SAT. This is about changing the way in which we admit everyone to school. This is about changing the way in which we teach everyone to be lawyers. This is about changing the way in which we think about lawyering. It's about changing the way in which we think about being a police officer. It's about changing the way in which we think about being educators. So the goal, as I said, is to short-term climb backwards up that cheese grater, but only do it in the long-term service of a vision to share power, not to hoard it. Thank you very much.
Lani Guinier, the first black woman tenured law professor at Harvard University, giving a keynote address to the U.S. National Women's Studies Association, June 14, 2000. Guinier's speech was recorded and edited for Wings by Frieda Worden. Lani Guinier was one of the most prolific and sought-after legal scholars in the United States. She published 5 books focused largely on democratization and social justice. She died at age 71, January 7, 2022. Wings thanks your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hey, Cher. I think you're pretty funny.
I think you're pretty funny, too, Tara.
Well, that's good because, you know, 30 Years of Nonsense is a great show, and we do it every Thursday from 4 to 5.
We absolutely do, and people can listen in at CFRC 101.9 or CFRC.ca.
Yeah, and we play basically all of our music from the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and current in all different genres.
And we share all of our nonsense and memories. I really hope people listen in.
Me too. See you there.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic. every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record. What you